Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele are a team, a comedy team. Both are biracial, half black, half white.
And so we actually think that we're particularly adept at lying because on a daily basis, we constantly have to adjust our blackness.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know.
Like, I mean, to terrify white people.
Yep, to terrify white people. That's one of the main reasons. And then,
because, I mean, with our voices now, we sound very white. We are not intimidating anybody
the way
we talk.
Yeah, we sound whiter than the black dude in the college a cappella group. That's how white we sound.
NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports on their new sketch comedy series, which premieres on Comedy Central next week.
You can learn a lot about Key and Peele in a sketch they do in which Jordan Peele impersonates President Obama.
I just want to say that I know a lot of people out there seem to think that I don't get angry. That's just not true.
And Keegan-Michael Key plays Luther, Mr. Obama's anger translator.
Luther, first off, concerning the recent developments in the Middle Eastern region, I just want to reiterate our unflinching support for all people and their right to a democratic process.
Hey, all y'all dictators out there, keep messing around and see what happens. Just see what happens. Watch.
Keegan-Michael Key paces back and forth, flails his arms. Sometimes he puts his face right into the camera like he's about to punch it. As President Obama, Jordan Peele is unflappable.
I just want to say to my critics, I hear your voices, and I'm aware of your concerns.
So maybe if you can chill the out for like a second, then maybe I can focus on some, you know?
Key and Peele say the idea came from a few different sources. First, they're fans of early Saturday Night Live, and one of their favorite sketches was the fake TV news.
If you remember Garrett Morris, and they say, and now for the Association of the Deaf, Garrett Morris will be doing the announcement. And then Garrett Morris would scream at the top of his lungs.
Our top story tonight.
And so that was something we had talked about that we thought, wouldn't it be nice, you know, if we could find a way to finagle Obama's nature and use that as a nugget? You know what I mean? How would we get someone to interpret what we know he really wants to say?
They were even more inspired to write the sketch when a congressman shouted, "You lie," during one of President Obama's speeches.
The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegal.
He and Peele say it bothered them that Mr. Obama barely reacted.
For him to have that much composure, it's
right.
Like, you don't have, no, not after that. It was really a burr. Jordan Sadler, he's like, come on, brother, if there's ever a time to get down to business, do it. How are you just going to put a finger up and keep talking regular?
Right.
Come on, man.
But, you know, that's kind of course, what we love about him, too, is that he's so, you know, he's so even measured. He's so together. He's almost Spock-like
yeah.
in his logic and wisdom. You know?
And that Spock-like nature is something else about the president Key and Peele admire. Peele thinks Mr. Obama was the best thing to happen to black nerds everywhere.
Up until Obama, it was basically Urkel and the black guy from Revenge of the Nerds, Lamar. We had no role models. So he made us cool.
And they say he made it easier to be biracial. Jordan Peele grew up in New York. He was raised by a single white mother. Keegan-Michael Key was raised in Detroit. His mom is also white.
You go to school as a kid, and when your mom comes and the kids go, that's not your mom.
That ain't your mama. Mm. Why are you lying?
Which, as a kid, is like, that is a deep insult.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
that's our lifeline is our mom when we're little. So somehow, I think that's that expectation at a very young age that we were supposed to live up to something because of what we looked like. I mean, I think that probably invaded our souls and gave us the need to do this comedy on some level.
Yeah, yeah. I think,
did anyone ever make fun of you growing up because you didn't talk black enough?
Every single day of grade school.
I still make fun of him.
In one of their sketches, Key and Peele change the way they speak, depending on who's listening. It begins with Key by himself on a city sidewalk, talking on his cell phone.
Because you're my wife, and you love the theater, and it's your birthday.
A stranger walks up, played by Jordan Peele, who can hear what he's saying. So Key changes his voice to sound more black.
But they do have seats that are still left in the dress circle. So if you want me to get them theater tickets right now, I'm going to do it right
now. What's up, dog? I'm about 5 minutes away.
Yeah.
As they part, you realize that the second guy had been changing his voice, too.
So he got that
oh, my God, Christian, I almost totally just got mugged right now. I love the posturing of it. I love that it taps into like stuff that no one's talking about.
Makisha Madden-Toby is a TV critic for the Detroit News.
How do people perceive you versus who you really are? How you let people perceive you? I mean, all of those things, I think they just brilliantly tap into those things.
Madden-Toby says Key and Peele will fill the void that was left on Comedy Central when comedian Dave Chappelle quit his show in 2005.
Comedy Central needed that voice again ever since losing Chappelle, and I think that they are pretty close to it.
Key and Peele are huge Chappelle fans, but for now, they're not sure their new show will reach as many African Americans as Chappelle's did. A tough crowd, they say.
It really concerns us.
To be terribly frank, yeah. That's just one of the things, I guess.
It concerns us that African Americans enjoy this show.
Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele. Their new show debuts next week on Comedy Central. Sketches include parodies of a reality cooking show, being related to Thomas Jefferson, and the little lies husbands tell each other about their wives. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is Morning Edition, edited by Renita Jablonski and Chuck Holmes. Our editorial staff includes Rena Advani, Shanita Anderson, Frederica Boswell, Jordana Hochman, Laura Krantz, Maeve McGoran, David McGuffin, and Jessica Smith with Nina Gregory at NPR West. Our senior supervising editors are Kitty Isley and Shannon Rhodes, and our executive producer is Metallica Sicka. The executive editor of news programming is Ellen McDonald. And our theme music was written by B.J. Lederman, arranged by Jim Pugh. You can follow us on Twitter, by the way. We are at Morning Edition and at NPR Inskeep. That's Inskeep. Renee's back with us on Monday. I'm Steve Inskeep. Now, when it comes to the process of buying a car, you may or may not find the following fact surprising. Women get better deals than men. A new study shows women do a lot more background work when car shopping. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports on one of the hidden powers of the Internet.
Buying a car is all about information, knowing about the car, the price, the financing terms. John Sternel is with LeaseTrader.com, and he's been studying how men and women shop for cars.
Our data specifically says that women not only have a larger interest in cars overall, but women today are taking a more active role in the negotiating process of a vehicle and in the car shopping process in general.
Sternel says women do more research, especially on the internet, than men, and because of that, they get better deals. And according to Kelley Blue Book, women are more likely to decide on a price before they go shopping for their next car, which also translates into savings.
The assumption still remains today that women aren't car people.
Rebecca Lindland is certainly a car person. She's a senior analyst with IHS Automotive. She says even when she goes car shopping, she's often ignored or talked down to.
We know that people expect us to fail to some extent, that people think that we're not going to know what we're talking about. So we overprepare, we overcompensate.
Lindland says part of the reason women do more research is a defense mechanism. They want to avoid the hassle of the dealership.
We don't go into a dealership to browse. We go in and we know exactly what we want. The shoe department is for browsing for women. You know, so when a woman goes into a dealership, you got to pay attention to her because we know what we want. We're in there for a very specific reason. And it's that kind of decisiveness that really manufacturers need to understand and take advantage of when people come into a dealership.
Both Sternel and Lindland say that's a lesson the car industry needs to learn quick because the influence of women on car buying is only growing. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The U.S. is filled with Chinese-made products, but the reverse is not true yet. U.S. companies have had a hard time getting Chinese consumers to buy American. There are lots of complicated reasons involving currency and saving rates, but there's also a simple reason. Sometimes American products need a little help translating. Robert Smith of NPR's Planet Money team has the story of how one iconic American brand struggled in China.
I hold in my hand a normal Oreo cookie.
Do you mean an American Oreo cookie?
Yeah, I guess I do. There was a day when all Oreos were American. But Lorna Davis works in a very different world.
I'm in Cookie Land.
And Cookie Land these days spans the globe. Davis was born in South Africa, ran the Oreo cookie brand in China, and is now calling from a biscuit conference in India, which is why I have to be very specific about which kind of Oreo I'm holding. It is round.
Yes.
Black and white. And the taste, well, this is where it gets complicated.
There are 135 components of an Oreo cookie. So there's bitterness, there's roastedness, burntness.
And then there's the white stuff. I just scraped some off with my bottom teeth.
And that is generally quite sweet and quite creamy.
And it has been for 100 years. So no one gave the recipe much thought when Kraft Foods introduced the Oreo cookie to China in the 1990s. Slap a Chinese label on there and you're good to go.
Oh, 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 bright ideas and an Oreo cookie. It's a bright
Lorna Davis says Oreo did okay in China, but it wasn't huge. I know it seems crazy, but it wasn't until a decade later when Kraft started to really ask the Chinese consumer what they thought of the Oreo.
They said it's a little bit too sweet and it's a little bit too bitter.
And it turns out that if you didn't grow up with Oreos and all that emotional attachment, it's a weird tasting little thing. And this started a whole process in the Chinese division of Kraft of rethinking what the essence of an Oreo cookie really is. They changed the recipe and made the cookie more chocolatey, the cream less intensely sweet.
So they said, this is a better balance.
And then it started to sell. But the amazing thing was that once Davis's team began to tinker with the classic features of an Oreo, why not go all the way? Why does it have to be black and white?
I have here a green one. This is green tea?
Green tea ice cream.
Why does an Oreo even need to be round? Kraft sent me a rectangular Oreo about the length of my index finger. It's kind of difficult to twist open in the traditional manner.
I feel like I've never eaten an Oreo before in my life because it's falling all over the place.
But it dunks pretty well.
So it almost becomes a philosophical question. What is an Oreo if it isn't round, black, and crazy sweet? What is the essential Oreo-ness? What the Chinese team at Kraft figured out is that an Oreo is an experience. Their shorthand for it, twist, lick, and dunk. All their crazy new shapes and flavors of Oreo wouldn't work in China unless they could somehow build up that same emotional resonance that Americans feel about the cookie.
In the early days, people said there's no way that Chinese consumers will twist, lick, and dunk because that's a very strangely American habit.
But luckily for the Oreo team, the Chinese consumer was just starting to respond to American-style emotional advertising. Oreo launched a series of TV ads in China where cute children demonstrate to their parents and other adults how to eat an Oreo cookie in the American style. Here's a cute kid with basketball star Yao Ming getting instruction.
Yao Ming,
you know how to eat Oreo? Of course I know. Xian Yao Yao.
And to see a father humbly listening to his child explain this new ritual seemed to really connect with Chinese consumers.
Davis says they saw sales of Oreos double in China, then double again, and again. It's now the best-selling cookie there. And there's a lesson.
Any foreign company that comes to China and says, oh, goody, goody, there's, you know, 1.5 billion people here, and I only need 1% of that, and I've heard that from so many people, you're going to get into trouble because you have to understand the way the consumers operate.
And sometimes the results surprise you. That rectangular wafer Oreo is no longer just in China. You can now buy it in Canada and in Australia. And perhaps someday, it will come home to the United States for the first time. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. We're going to report next on a sign of progress amid the rubble in Haiti. 2 years after an earthquake, 500,000 people are still living in camps. But people who want to help can now point to one project that is working well enough its supporters call it a possible model for international aid in the developing world. NPR's Jason Beaubien reports on a new national teaching hospital being built outside Port-au-Prince.
Even before the earthquake, Haiti's public health care system was one of the worst in the hemisphere. Then the quake knocked down clinics, killed medical workers, and severely damaged the general hospital in Port-au-Prince. Now, the Boston-based group Partners in Health has set out to build a world-class hospital in what used to be a rice field in the Haitian countryside.
This is a little waiting area for the main laboratory and radiology.
Dr. David Walton is overseeing the construction of the National Teaching Hospital, 35 miles outside the capital in the small city of Mirbalay. Walton is a physician with Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, but on this day he looks more like a construction foreman. He says this hospital, which will be part of the public health care system, will provide services and a level of care that's light years ahead of what's currently available in Haiti. For instance, the hospital will be wired with a fiber optic data connection.
We'll have cameras in the operating room, in the lights, so that you can see surgery from anywhere. That will allow surgeons in whatever country to be able to comment on and assist in the technical details of a surgery that's being done right here in Haiti. So, again, leveraging technology to improve care here.
When it opens this summer, it will be the largest hospital in the country. There'll be 6 operating theaters, an emergency room, and a neonatal intensive care unit. It will be the only public facility in Haiti with a CAT scan machine.
Now, back in Boston where I work, there's about maybe 12 CAT scanners in one single hospital. Here, there are only 4 in the country. 3 of them are in the private sector, so this will be the 4th, and it'll be for the people of Haiti.
The roof will be covered in solar panels, allowing the facility, on sunny days, to run entirely on solar power. Partners in Health's budget for this massive 320-bed, 180,000-square-foot facility is just $16 million. Walton notes that they've gotten another $4 million worth of in-kind donations, mainly medical equipment and construction supplies. But the final price tag for this new national teaching hospital will be less than 1% of the billions of dollars in international aid that were pledged to Haiti in the aftermath of the earthquake.
One of the lessons that I think this hospital can provide is how to provide really outstanding infrastructure and construction practices at a fraction of what it may cost in other settings. And I would argue a fraction of what it may cost versus other projects that are being done here.
The Canadian government this month just pledged $20 million to move squatters out of a huge tent encampment in front of the National Palace. Looking around Haiti, this hospital is one of the few solid examples of post-quake reconstruction. There are private projects to build new hotels, an industrial park is under construction, the cell phone company Digicel rebuilt the historic iron market in Port-au-Prince, but the National Palace is still awaiting demolition. Many of the cholera clinics that have sprung up are in tents or temporary shelters. At a dedication for the hospital, just before the second anniversary of the earthquake, the Haitian Minister of Health, Dr. Florence Guillaume, said this project for her is a dream come true.
I can tell you, I'm really proud. You're almost crying this morning. You know, it's really that type of assistance that we need.
She says this hospital will help bolster the entire public health care system in Haiti. First, other clinics and hospitals will be able to refer patients here for more complicated procedures and tests. Second, as a teaching hospital, it will help train more Haitian doctors and nurses. And by providing a better work environment, she hopes it will help stem the exodus of Haitian medical professionals who so often decamp for the U.S. or Canada. Paul Farmer, the co-founder of Partners in Health, says that he views this hospital project as a model for effective international aid.
The amount of money either pledged or flying out there around somewhere is substantial. If it were marshaled into a coherent system of hospitals, health centers, health posts, then you could see some big, big advancements in public health indices in Haiti. And in fact, that's what we expect to happen.
The National Teaching Hospital still faces large challenges. Construction is on track, but still not complete. At first, the Ministry of Health and Partners in Health will manage the facility together. But eventually, the Haitian government needs to come up with an operating budget to keep the hospital running for the long term. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
Now, as Congress debates big issues like that, lobbyists for corporations also play a big role. And disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff is offering explanations for how it's done. He's out of prison, he has a new book, and he told Planet Money's Alex Bloomberg about things he did that were legal.
The firm Abramoff worked for was called Greenberg Traurig. I chose a year at random when Abramoff was working there and picked a client who I hoped would be fairly typical, not one of the Indian tribes that were at the center of the scandal, but a multinational corporation, Tyco International. In 2003, they gave Abramoff's firm $1.3 million. What were they hoping to get for that money?
They were fighting to stay out of the tax bill that year, which would have retroactively taxed them to the tune of about $4 billion.
Tyco, you may remember at this time, was just coming out of a big scandal involving their CEO, Dennis Kozlowski. And Senator Charles Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, had introduced a bill with a provision that targeted companies like Tyco who maintained an offshore tax status. The provision would have imposed new taxes on Tyco going back to 1997. So Abramoff and his team targeted the bill's sponsor, Charles Grassley.
What we did was we plied him with contributions.
Abramoff got everyone he could to make donations to Grassley's reelection campaign. Abramoff himself donated, as did other people at his firm. Executives and employees at Tyco did. But there are limits to how much each individual can give. Abramoff had to expand the circle of people willing to donate. Fortunately, Tyco was just one of many clients that Abramoff's firm represented.
I went to every client I could and rounded up every check we could for him. Look, access is vital in lobbying. If you can't get in the door, you can't make your case. Here we had a hostile senator whose staff was hostile, and we had to get in. So that's the sort of lobbyist safecracker method is raise money and become a big donor.
Perhaps you're wondering, how much can I trust a convicted felon like Jack Abramoff? Well, he's a convicted felon with a lot of old emails in his inbox, some of which he forwarded to me from around this time. And they suggest the safecracking worked. One email to Abramoff from his head lobbyist starts, quote, "I ran this morning with Senator Grassley and had breakfast with two staffers and his wife at his house." He goes on, quote, "Looks like I'll be doing it every Wednesday morning." In another email, the woman in charge of raising money for Grassley's reelection campaign, who's on Grassley's campaign staff, writes to Abramoff's lobbyist to ask about an event Abramoff's firm is holding to raise money for Senator Grassley. She asks, quote, "What do you think would be a realistic number?" Meaning, how much can you raise? The answer, 30 grand. Overall, it's hard to figure out exactly how much Abramoff, his firm, and his clients raised for Charles Grassley. Somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 seems like a safe range. And in fact, the provision that Tyco was concerned about was removed. But here's the question. Was it removed by Charles Grassley?
I'm Colin Davis. During the 2003-04 period, I was the Republican staff director, chief counsel of the Senate Finance Committee.
A committee Grassley chaired. Grassley's office, understandably, was not eager to be mentioned in a story with the man who has come to symbolize corruption in Washington. Especially since, they say, Grassley wasn't the one who removed the Tyco provision. The House did it. Their version of the bill kept that provision out.
Both sides have to support it, and the House voted it down.
So the lobbying efforts, all those lobbying efforts that Jack Abramoff went through, what you're telling me is essentially that was just wasted time and money.
I think the facts bear that out.
The facts Davis refers to are these. After the House removed the Tyco provision the first time, Grassley tried to put it back in. The House voted to take it out again. Grassley, in other words, did not behave like a man whose mind was changed by lobbying. But Abramoff says he didn't need to change Grassley's mind. He just needed to take the fight out of him. And honestly, it's impossible to know who to believe, the convicted felon or the senator trying to distance himself from the convicted felon. But this is what I can say. What Abramoff and his emails describe is absolutely legal and absolutely routine. Every day in Washington, lobbyists who want something from lawmakers are rounding up checks for them. At every meal of every day, lawmakers who desperately need those checks to get reelected are meeting with the lobbyists to accept the checks. What Abramoff describes is not an aberration, not even unusual. It's simply the way the system works. Alex Bloomberg, NPR News.
On a military procurement manifest, they are S9s. But when the quartermaster at boot camp hands you your new eyeglasses, you are holding a pair of BCGs. That's shorthand for birth control glasses, thick-framed with large lenses said to make the wearer so unattractive that chances of connecting with a member of the opposite sex are vanishingly small. Well, now, the military is offering a new style, a nod to the fact that the standard-issue spectacles are so ugly, many troops stuff them in the back of their trunk as soon as they leave training. Well, joining me now is Dr. Edward Grout, a retired Navy optometrist who now practices in Jacksonville, Florida. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Tell us, first of all, about BCGs. Do they deserve that unfortunate name?
Well, I believe that they do. Over the years, you know, when I entered the Navy initially, we had some gray frames, and then we went to some black frames. When the brown frames came out, we were all a little disappointed in the appearance, and judging by the expression that I would see on the active duty people when they were picking up the glasses, I would have to say that that designation of birth control glasses was appropriate.
So you were not making these people feel cool when they got their glasses. What about the choices that are available now?
Well, I think time will probably tell whether or not the new 5A frame will be considered an improvement. I believe that it will, because of the fact that nowadays there seems to be a little more stylish for a lot of individuals to go back to that Buddy Holly appearance.
So the new frames, which are black,
yes,
are different in color from the brown ones? That
Yes.
But in shape and size, are they remarkably different?
You know, they are a little bit different. I believe that there's possibly a little less vertical dimension to the lens.
A little less Harry Potter look there in the glasses.
Yes, exactly. And they will come, obviously, in several different frame sizes.
You know, your observation about Buddy Holly-like frames, and I was reading recently about the fact that John Lennon made granny glasses chic. They were the free glasses the Brits got from the National Health Service for poor people.
Yes,
This would suggest that if you're going to take anywhere from the mid-90s until 2012 for the military to introduce new frames, why bother? By that time, the old styles could come back.
Well, you know, that is true. The only thing that I would say is that from the mid-90s on, the active duty, once they got out of their basic training, did have a little bit of a choice. It was mainly the recruits, the people that were entry-level people were the ones that had absolutely no choice, were given that S9 frame. That's probably why it may be that it wasn't possibly the highest priority item to work on.
Well, Dr. Grout, thank you very much for talking with us about the military,
sure,
and eyeglass frames.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Grout is an optometrist in Jacksonville, Florida, and he is a retired Navy optometrist. We're talking about the military's replacement of the old S9s with new, not brown, but black eyeglass frames. PCGs. In my PCGs. No one's falling like me. I come from a place called the Naval. While the old BCG frames might not have inspired many romances, they did inspire this YouTube video. When I go out, all the girlies say, hey, they say I'm king of the DT. Hey, when I'm in town trying to please the masses, I don't have to worry, got my birth control glasses. It was produced by midshipmen at the Naval Academy, celebrating the military's iconic, ugly, and now retired eyeglass frames.
All Things Considered continues right after this.